Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, television as a guide to how the other half lives, or more accurately, the other 1%. We'll spend this hour with Rob Henderson, who was raised in the foster care system before being adopted by working class parents who split up soon after he entered their lives. While Henderson's mom was at work, TV served as his companion and babysitter and his window into how wealthier people lived and what they wanted. Henderson says he started thinking about college because the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air did, and now he's studying for his PhD at Cambridge. Our conversation starts after a short break. Henderson did not have the kind of childhood that is supposed to position a guy for success. His immigrant birth mother gave him up for adoption when he was three, and then he bounced around the foster care system until he was adopted at the age of seven by a working-class couple who divorced just a couple of years after that. His new father cut ties, so while Henderson's mom worked long hours, he was left home a lot to watch TV. Rugrats and Family Matters when he was little, Fresh Prince and The O.C. as he reached his teens. Not exactly high art, but TV for a kid like him was more than just a babysitter. It was a window into middle-class American values and a preview of possibilities he might otherwise never have imagined for himself. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Today, Rob Henderson is an Air Force veteran, a Yale graduate, and a PhD student at the University of Cambridge. He wrote recently about his unorthodox life path in an essay for the New York Times opinion page titled, "Everything I Know About Elite America I Learned from Fresh Prince and West Wing." Rob, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So obviously, you know your personal history of entering foster care when you were three. I'm curious about what you remember of that time. Do you have memories of being with your birth mother or of leaving her?
Yeah, I mean, I have sort of two specific memories from my birth mother. So, you know, I was born in Los Angeles. So my earliest memory from age three, I was sitting in my mother's lap. We were in an apartment somewhere, I think in Lancaster, somewhere in LA. And I just remember these two guys, these two police officers standing over us. And of course, at age three, I didn't really know what they were there for or what the, you know, why they wanted to sort of remove me and then take my mom away. And so I was sort of burying my face into her lap, just like clinging to her, hoping that like these guys would just disappear. Hmm. And then the next memory that I have, I'm sitting in this long white hallway. And I have this like box of chocolate milk that I'm drinking sitting next to my mom on a bench. And then I like sneeze or something and I drop the milk and it spills all over the floor. And I'm looking at my mom for help, but she can't help me because she's wearing handcuffs.
Hmm. What do you know about why she wasn't able to take care of you?
Yeah, so my mom was addicted to drugs. Got, you know, just basically really deep into her addiction and would get high and just be a neglectful parent. I don't have a lot of memories of that, you know, maybe fortunately, but I, you know, from the caseworkers, the social workers who were involved, later learned that, you know, I would be sort of like screaming, like trying to get my mom's attention. And eventually some neighbors overheard and called the police and, you know, said there's a kid over there who's always screaming. And they sort of investigated, looked into it, and saw that she was just in a terrible state and was unable to care for me.
So you lived in seven foster homes over the course of 4 years, which, I mean, would be disruptive for anybody, especially such a little kid. You know, those are the ages, those preschool ages, when you kind of need everything to be stable all the time. What do you remember about figuring out the sort of house rules and house culture each time you changed families?
Yeah, I mean, early on, it was, you know, I just remember living in houses with just a bunch of other kids. I mean, some of these houses I remember had, you know, 7, 8, sometimes 10 kids living in them. And it was just sort of like learning to get along and, you know, trying to like get enough to eat because, you know, when foster parents are trying to feed that many kids, sometimes it can, you know, they can be overlooked. I remember later, you know, I lived with this foster family and they weren't, the primary you know, caretaker was this Filipino woman who didn't speak English that well. And I remember I would go to school and I tried to get lunch, and they said I needed to, you know, bring this form back to my foster parents to get the free lunch program. And I showed it to her and she wasn't able to understand what it was. So I went, you know, a few months in this school, basically not ever eating lunch, which, you know, probably contributed to my sort of lack of ability to focus, and took a while for me to sort of learn how to write, how to read. And I was sort of falling back a lot in school as well. I think I'd gone to like four or five different schools by the time I reached second grade.
So one of the memories you have in foster care is of like arguing with your foster siblings for control of the TV. And it made me think that like TV might have been a kind of through line for you, right? People who acted as your parents or your siblings would change pretty often when you were small, but the families on Full House and Family Matters were consistent.
Yeah, that's right. We'd watch, you know, cartoons, we would watch sitcoms, Rugrats, Family Matters, Power Rangers. Just like all those sort of old 90s era TV shows. And that was one thing that was consistent. Like you said, no matter where I lived, I would sort of like know the characters of my favorite shows and could sort of follow along with them. So that was like a sense of comfort. It was sort of self-soothing in a sense to watch those. And it wasn't even just like little kid shows. I remember like MTV was big back then and like music videos. I was probably too young to be watching some of those, but I remember like Waterfalls by TLC, like that song, like I just remember that as like the anthem of like my early childhood because it was playing everywhere and it was on TV a lot.
So when you were adopted, did it initially feel different than moving to just another foster home?
It did and it didn't. I felt immediately, I think, more at ease when I was adopted with my new parents. Simply because like they expressed a lot of like interest in me upfront, right? They would ask me questions about myself and, you know, like buy things for me. So I had met them once before I moved in with them, and they came for a visit when I was living in my final foster home. And I really just got along with them, maybe because I had become so used to getting along with new people, but I got along with them and they were really nice to me. And so when they said like, you're living with us and you're not going to be moving again. I really liked the sound of that. But still, like when I first got into the new house or, you know, where we were living, I was still sort of like felt that familiar surge of heightened alertness when I moved into a place. I was always just a little bit wary, like trying to figure out the sort of lay of the land, who lives here, who doesn't. Because one of the things that I, you know, just wasn't used to was having a stable set of people living in the same place with me. Because it wasn't just me who was always moving. My foster siblings would always be changing too. So that sort of stability of like knowing who's going to be living here this week, where am I going to be living this week? So that was a new feeling for me to just stay in one place.
So you're adopted. Your family is in Red Bluff, California, which I had to look up. It's like a pretty small town in the north central part of the state. You are Asian American. Were there a lot of other people who looked like you in Red Bluff, California?
There were a couple. I mean, so the schools that I was in LA, the kids, it was like probably mostly Hispanic, some white kids, few Asian kids, and you know, some black kids. But in Red Bluff, it was like mostly like white working class with like a sizable percentage of Hispanic, Hispanic kids that I went to school with, and then like a few black kids and a few Asian kids, like very few though. And I, you know, my own background, my biological mother was from Seoul, from South Korea. My father, we're not actually sure of his ethnic background, but my social workers, you know, they suggested that he was probably white. But my adoptive mother, interestingly enough, so she was also from like born in Seoul, but she herself was adopted by a white working class family in Oregon when she was 2 years old. So even though she sort of looks and has she looks like she's an Asian American person, but her outlook and her sort of cultural worldview, I guess, is that of sort of like a working class person from, you know, smaller towns in Oregon and California.
This is like a really complicated macrame, all the threads that make up your early life. So your parents split up a couple of years after adopting you. Your mom, I gather, was left as like sole breadwinner, which meant you were by yourself a lot. How did you use TV to fill that time?
Yeah, so, you know, my adoptive parents split when I was 9. And so, you know, my mom would go off to work and I'd walk in the mornings to school, I'd walk home from school. And, you know, my mom would usually be sort of on her way to work by the time I got up, and she'd be still at work when I got home. So I'd, you know, have the TV on for most of that time. And yeah, at that point I was sort of watching, yeah, like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was big back then. And yeah, Boy Meets World, some of those other sort of shows targeted at like, you know, early adolescent kids and teens. So those were always on in the background. And then my mom would kind of come home and, you know, say like, okay, you've watched enough TV today. She'd try to like limit my consumption and try to get me to do my homework and you know, those kinds of things. But I loved watching TV. And you know, at first I wasn't trying to draw any lessons. It was just, you know, like I said before, this sort of self-soothing, familiar comfort for me.
Mm-hmm. So you get your first job when you're 15. What did money mean to you at that time?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of financial sort of instability in my family and in the families and lives of the people around me. So I noted in that New York Times piece, the median household income in Red Bluff was like $27,000 a year. So it was a very poor town. Red Bluff itself is ranked consistently as either the third or the fourth most dangerous city in California. And of course, you know, a lot of that is due to poverty. So I worked with, you know, my first job I got, you know, I was 15 years old. I worked as a dishwasher at this local Italian restaurant. A lot of my coworkers were sort of like early 20s. Some of them in their 30s. And yeah, I mean, a lot of them were just sort of barely getting by. My family was, you know, sort of barely getting by. And so we talk about, you know, what we would do if we, you know, won the lottery or struck it rich, you know, sort of crack jokes or whatever. You know, I'd buy a boat, I'd buy a big house on the beach somewhere. And it was sort of like these daydreams or these fantasies of, you know, suddenly obtaining this windfall of money.
So you hadn't yet, I mean, you could imagine, understandably, how a lot of money would change your life, but you hadn't really parsed any difference between income and social class. What was it that didn't occur to you about the ways these things might not always intersect?
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of the people around me, you know, they didn't go to college. I mean, it was sort of like they... we were urged to by the teachers in high school. Mm-hmm. I mean, they, you know, they sort of promoted it. Oh, college is a good thing. You should aim to be going to college. But, you know, my family and a lot of the families of my friends and my coworkers, obviously, they didn't go to college. Many of them, or I think most of them. And so, yeah, I mean, even though it was sort of respected sort of this goal that we were told that we should strive for, it just wasn't pushed that hard on us. And so we were more preoccupied, of course, with money. For us, like, you know, of course, I wasn't thinking that much about class at 15. But for me, you know, if you ask, like, you know, what does elite mean, or what does sort of being like a top respected person in society, I would have said it's, you know, it's having a lot of money. But you know, as I noted in that piece, as I started, you know, that essay, as I started absorbing more of the sort of messages and the subtleties in television plots, I noticed that, you know, like why does Will Smith, who lives with, you know, his rich aunt and uncle in Bel Air, like, why is he trying to get into college? Like, why is Carlton? I mean, he's, you know, he would like make these jokes about his inheritance and like, clearly, this is a very rich family. So why do they care so much about applications and college and going away and all these things? And it was the same kind of story in the OC, which I really liked in high school too. These really rich kids who, you know, were obsessed with getting into the right colleges. That was thing that I didn't quite understand why, but I knew that, okay, well, if my favorite characters in these TV shows are interested, then maybe I should be too.
My guest is Rob Henderson. He's a PhD student at the University of Cambridge and recently wrote an essay called Everything I Know About Elite America, I Learned from Fresh Prince and West Wing. We'll be right back.
Scores up, and I'll recommend that you get accepted into Princeton.
I go, I don't know, Ed. It's just...
Oh, please, for me. It would mean a lot.
I'll think about it.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was a clip from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, where Will Smith's character is interviewing to get into Princeton. It sounds like he might be talking to John Lithgow, but I can't picture the episode. My guest this hour is Rob Henderson. He's joining us from England, where he's a PhD student at the University of Cambridge. Recently, he wrote an essay that we found fascinating for the New York Times opinion page called Everything I Know About Elite America, I Learned from Fresh Prince and West Wing. So, literally, you started thinking, well, maybe if Will Smith is going to college, maybe I should think about it. But of course, life is not a TV show, so it didn't sort of proceed that the next day you started working on your grades. How was this sort of germinating in the back of your mind as you made the decision instead to join the military for a few years?
Yeah, I mean, well, one reason why, you know, I didn't go immediately to college right after high school is because I just didn't have the grades for it. You know, there was just a lot of drama and chaos in my family life. And, you know, as a result of that, and you know, I just wasn't a good student. I wasn't focused enough. I was always kind of a curious kid. I would read a lot, you know, in addition to all the TV I was watching, I'd also like, you know, sort of stop by the school library on my own to check out books. I would read the textbooks that were, you know, the readings that were assigned in class, but I just wouldn't do any of the homework. And I would just sort of do the bare minimum to get like a C minus in each class was like my goal, just barely pass. And so, yeah, I mean, by the time I started to put the pieces together with The Fresh Prince, with the OC, with these shows I was watching, you know, Boy Meets World, you know, all of them wanted to go to college. But by the time that clicked in my mind, my grades were just way too bad for that to be like a you know, serious option for me. So I sort of put that on the back burner and thought like, well, what's the next sort of option for me for how to get out of this town and to sort of escape, you know, what I've been experiencing here. And so the next step, you know, for me was to join the military. You know, one of my teachers had been in the military. He said, you know, maybe it's a good idea for you. He could tell that I had some sort of latent potential that just wasn't, you know, just wasn't manifesting where I was. And so he sort of suggested it might be a good idea. There was a friend of mine, his father had been in the military, and I think he maybe could see the same kinds of underlying potential in me, but also knew that I wasn't in the right place for that to express itself yet. So both of them thought, you know, maybe the structure of the military will keep you out of trouble enough for you to take some time to mature and to think and to maybe go to college later.
It sounds like there were always people in your life who recognized there was something special about you. I wonder how long it took for you to start to recognize those qualities in yourself.
It took a long time. Even in the military, you know, it was one of the first times I really experienced like, you know, this sort of pride or this feeling that like, wow, I can actually do things if I set my mind to it. And so, yeah, I felt like really sort of this, my self-esteem and everything, I just felt better. But I was still getting into trouble and doing some things that I shouldn't have been doing. It wasn't maybe until maybe around the time of my first deployment, I was 20 and I was in, I was deployed in the Middle East. And I mean, we were working, you know, 12 to 16 hour days, didn't really have any days off. I mean, we had one day off, but we always got called in. I was working with, you know, my coworkers, and yeah, it was probably there that I started to think that like, wow, I can't believe I'm over here and I'm doing this. And I started to feel like, okay, maybe I can start thinking about some next steps for myself and start thinking about college.
So what is the Warrior Scholar Project and how did you find your way to it?
Yeah, so, you know, as my enlistment was winding down, I started to think, you know, how do I get into college? Like, I didn't know the process. I didn't know what the Common App was. I didn't know, like, even the most basic fundamental steps, you know, and I was, at this point, I was in my early 20s. I had never taken the SAT, like, just, it was a sort of burnout in high school. So I didn't have that connection to what the process is like to higher education. So I remember I was just, one evening I was like, I think I just Googled, like, how, you know, student veteran college questions or something like that. And just through sort of Googling and clicking around, I found, someone who had told me about the Warrior Scholar Project. And it was, it's essentially what they call themselves an academic boot camp, which is designed to help veterans get into college. And it was perfect for me. I mean, it was set up by, a couple of students at Yale and, you know, later expanded to other campuses. But it was basically a way for a student or veterans who were interested in becoming college students to take a couple of weeks and spend time with, you know, college professors who were involved in this program, with college students who were tutors there, volunteering and working for the summer, and to just spend 2 weeks there, learn how to write an essay, learn like the process of applying to college, how to ask for recommendation letters, you know, how to study for the SAT, resources for all of these kinds of things. So that was a really sort of big. It was just sort of an enlightening experience for me. It really changed for me what I thought was possible.
So there was this guy you got to be friends with through the project who was watching this show that you had never heard of, never seen before, watching on his laptop. What was the show?
Yeah, so I remember, daily, the daily program at the Warrior Scholar Project, it's like, you know, first thing in the morning, you go to this lecture, and then you sort of like take these writing workshops and read some pages out of a book and attend these seminar style discussions. But we had a lot of unstructured time, usually closer to the evenings as well, where we would just sort of socialize and hang out with the veterans who were there and the tutors. All of them, I think, were college students, and many of them were students at like top universities, like, you know, Yale, Harvard, Dartmouth, like, you know, these really top schools. And so it was just like an interesting experience, I guess, like talking to them and seeing just, you know, what they were like, what they thought about things. But yeah, there was this one guy who had just graduated, and he was, you know, he was working with this program and he's watching this show. And I said, oh, what's that? And you know, he's like, oh, that's the West Wing. You don't know the West Wing? And I said, like, oh, I don't think so. And he said, like, oh, you really have to watch this. This is a great show. And I looked up, there was another tutor, this young woman, and she was like, yeah, you should really watch it. The show is like really, really good. And so, you know, I thought to myself, like, okay, well, here are these, you know, two sort of young, bright people, college students. I want to be a college student. If they're recommending the show to me, you know, even though it's not like academic in nature, maybe it's worth checking out just to sort of, you know, see. And I also had this sort of, you know, this worry or this anxiety that, like, you know, what if I do go to college and like maybe everyone who goes to college watches The West Wing and I'm the only one who doesn't watch it? I should at least like know what it is and like maybe know some of the characters from it. So that sort of convinced me to get into that show.
10 word answers can kill you in political campaigns. They're the tip of the sword. Here's my question. What are the next 10 words of your answer? Your taxes are too high, so are mine. Give me the next 10 words. How are we going to do it? Give me 10 after that. I'll drop out of the race right now. Every once in a while, there's a day with an absolute right and an absolute wrong. But those days almost always include body counts. Other than that, there aren't very many unnuanced moments in leading a country that's way too big for 10 words. I'm the president of the United States, not the president of the people who agree with me. By the way, if the left has a problem with that, they should vote for somebody else.
That was a clip of Martin Sheen as President Jed Bartlet from season 4 of The West Wing. I should say, Rob, you didn't really care for the show. What kept you plowing through the series?
Yeah. I mean, so I never finished the complete series, but I watched the first two seasons. And yeah, I just couldn't get into it. I think one reason could be because like the characters were just so like different than any of the characters I'd watched in the TV shows. I couldn't quite relate or identify with any of them. And, you know, I thought about this, like, why was this the case? But I remembered, you know, later on, I sort of figured it out, which is that it wasn't really meant for me. You know, it was meant for a specific demographic. So Aaron Sorkin, you know, the creator of The West Wing, he was in an interview with David Brooks, or a discussion with David Brooks. And he basically said that the pilot episode of The West Wing didn't really test well overall, but it tested extremely well with certain audience segments, certain demographics. And he listed three in particular. So one was households that earned more than $75,000 a year, which, you know, that wasn't my background. Households with at least one college graduate, which, you know, again, not my background. And then households that subscribe to the New York Times, right? So I guess the show sort of tested very well with the kinds of people like the students who recommended the show to me. They were the demo for that show, but I was not, which is probably like one big reason why I didn't really get super into the show.
So I wonder if it prepared you in any way to go to Yale. You were accepted after you finished your military service, where you would be surrounded by, I have to imagine, a majority of your classmates came from backgrounds just like the ones that tested well for The West Wing.
Yeah, it was. It was very much like that. Just a completely different environment. But one of the things that I liked about The West Wing was how people would have these sort of contentious political discussions and still like find ways to get along. One of the like scenes, I think this was a plot line from season two specifically, which I wrote about in that essay. Sam Seaborn lost a debate, a televised debate against a Republican named Ainsley Hayes, and then Ainsley Hayes is offered a job by President Bartlet in his, you know, Democrat administration. And he cites her sense of civic duty. And so I really liked that. I liked that, all of these characters were sort of idealistic and smart and so on. You know, even though I couldn't quite connect to that, I still found something about it appealing. And so that's kind of what I thought, what I sort of expected would be the case when I was applying to Yale, for example. I thought like, oh, you know, maybe it'll be like these people and watching the show will at least sort of help me to get along in that way.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Ken is calling from Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much. I wanted to call in after I heard gentlemen and your setup talking about how television influenced him in his life. I, as a young black kid, watched television without realizing that I was gleaning from it how to be and how to exist in the white world, frankly. Hmm. And I can think back now how it influenced me in such a way that I conducted myself according to how I thought they expected me to be. And I found that remarkable, and I wanted to call in and share that with you.
Are there things about that, Ken, before I let you go, are there things about that you think helped you, and other things that you think I shouldn't have had to change myself to please white people?
That is without a doubt. I'm 52 years old now, and I started coming to that realization maybe 15 years ago or so. I was in the corporate world, and I felt like I had to kind of sacrifice, part of what I was and part of what made me, my culture. And I felt like I was always carrying this weight that I, in some ways, put upon myself, but that I feel like white people around me appreciated me carrying.
Hmm. Thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. I really appreciate it. Is there anything, Rob, that Ken said that you can relate to?
Yeah, I mean, of course, like, you know, the discussions of sort of, you know, race and class, they're extremely complex. But to some extent, I think I sort of understand at least the idea that I myself had to change parts of myself to fit in to sort of this educated world. I had to, sort of learn new words, new vocabulary, new language, sort of just I had to learn how to be around these kinds of people. And so I think there is this sort of like, I don't know, this underlying burden to some extent of class mobility, which, maybe to some in some ways, to some extent, might be not unlike what Ken was talking about.
How did your Yale classmates treat you? I mean, you were several years older than most of the other undergrads. You had this experience in the military. Were they curious about your experiences, or did they think they could sum you up by just taking one look at you?
For the most part, the students on campus were sort of open minded and interested, and found the stories I would tell them to be sort of interesting. Some of them shocking. So as you can imagine, like not many people at Yale had the same background as me. I mean, even something like being an enlisted military veteran among the undergrads when I was there, and I don't think it's changed much. Out of however many it is, like 5,000-ish undergrads, I think 7 or 8 were veterans. So even just having served in the military made me a sort of outlier. But then having, the sort of background as a foster kid and everything else also sort of set me apart in a way. And early on, it was tough for me to sort of open up and talk about these things. But over time, I became more comfortable with it and became more forthcoming.
It was tough because you thought people wouldn't understand, or because you just, why was it tough?
One reason was because I thought they wouldn't understand. And another was just, I just didn't, so I wasn't aware, I guess, of just how unusual my life was. Hmm. So, of course, like when I was growing up, like everyone around me was sort of like had a similar story, roughly speaking. And then in the military, it was a little bit different. Like I met some middle-class people and some people who, found my story unusual, but still like in the realm of possibility in their world. But at Yale, it was so outside and I wasn't aware of that. And so I just wouldn't talk about it much. But then as people started to become interested in it, then I would speak more about it and realize like, oh, this is a really strange story.
My guest, Rob Henderson, is a PhD student at the University of Cambridge. His recent essay for the New York Times is Everything I Know About Elite America I Learned from Fresh Prince and West Wing. We'll be right back. This hour is Rob Henderson. He's an Air Force veteran, a Yale graduate, now a PhD student at the University of Cambridge. He wrote recently about his life in an essay for the New York Times opinion page titled Everything I Know About Elite America I Learned from Fresh Prince and West Wing. So you graduated from Yale. You're getting your PhD at Cambridge. I wonder if it's impossible for people now to sort of tell in just a brief interaction with you that your early life was really different than that of most of your peers?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not actually sure. So here in England, of course, like the complexities of class are just, it's just different than how it is in the US. So mm-hmm. I think when I talk to people here, if they learn that I went to Yale, I think they just sort of assume that like, oh, I had that background, right? Of someone who went to Yale. Something interesting that someone once told me is that like people view you as the last thing that you were in terms of like your professional life, right? And so at Yale, I was the military veteran because that was the last thing I was. And then here at Cambridge, I'm a Yale person, whatever, I'm a Yale graduate, and that was because that's the last thing I was. And so at least when I talk to Cambridge students, that might be how they perceive me. But if I talk to Yale students or Yale graduates, I'm not actually sure if I can totally get along. But I told a story in the New York Times essay. I was at this academic program in D.C. and I was talking to this guy, and he mistook me for coming from this wealthy background. I can't remember if he said he said something like you're probably rich, right, or you're probably wealthy, right, something like that. And I made this joke. I'm not rich. I just watch a lot of TV, and I just said it as this joke, but. It really wasn't. Part of the reason why I was at that academic program, and why you know, why I was, I had, you know, why I had gone to Yale was because of the TV that I had watched. It sort of propelled me and told me, you know, what to do and sort of the things that, that might be desirable for me.
I'm really curious about the kind of cultural code switching of people who grow up in one class environment and find their way to another. How do you, you know, you mentioned that person who said, well, you were probably a rich kid, right? I mean, how do you relate now to people who are presently in circumstances like the ones you grew up in?
Yeah, it's, I mean, so I still am friends with some of the guys I went to high school with, for example, who live just very different lives. I mean, so there was, you know, in high school, there was like a group of five of us. And now, you know, a couple of them are in prison. One of them works, you know, at a grocery store, and, you know, one of them is a car wash. And so, like, it's just completely different, a different milieu, I guess, than the one I'm in now. But I still stay in touch with some of them. And there are jokes and there is some light teasing. But, you know, one of the, it's tough on both ends now, because I notice when I talk to people in Red Bluff, you know, every once in a while I'll still visit. You know, I feel like this defensiveness come up, like, you know, when I was going to Yale, for example, one of my friends would say, oh, this is my friend Rob. He goes to Yale. And then I would immediately follow up with, yeah, but I just got out of the military. And that was sort of my way of like, don't categorize me as like some rich kid who went to Yale. Like I am still, you know, from Red Bluff. I still have like these sort of working class roots or whatever. And the military was my way to convey that.
So I know that you've mentored other students at this point. What is that process like for you? What I mean, I can imagine what you're able to give to the students you mentor. What does it do for you, that that relationship?
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of just like for me a way of paying it forward. There were a lot of people who helped me along the way, and one consistent response that I got when I would sort of like express to mentors or people who would help me, like, why would you do this? Like, there's no way I can really pay you back. And, you know, a consistent response was like, you don't have to worry about me. Like, I'm fine. Just pay it forward. You know, the next time you run into someone who needs help, you know, share the knowledge that you've sort of built up. And so when I was living in New Haven, for example, when I was in undergrad, I would volunteer at New Haven Reads as a reading tutor for sort of underprivileged kids around New Haven, kids who maybe had some challenges with their reading and writing skills. I know what that's like. I mean, no one really paid attention to me when I was a kid or taught me how to read, really. Like, I basically taught myself how to read. So I know sort of what that feeling is like, and that process of like thinking that, you know, I thought to myself, you know, maybe I'm just too dumb to learn how to do this, but that's not true. They just, you know, need someone to sort of guide them along. And I also understand that, like, I understand in ways that maybe other people don't, that sometimes when you're put in that environment of like, you know, there's this adult here telling you, you know, write this word or what did that sentence mean or whatever, like, you just don't want to do it. Like, you had the kind of day where you can't put yourself in the mind space to like do that kind of work. And so sometimes I'll just talk to these kids, or sometimes they wouldn't want to talk at all, and they would just sort of put their head on the desk. And, you know, I have no idea what they went through earlier that day. So I'm not going to sort of push them, because I went through some stuff myself. So I sort of can relate to them on that level.
It feels like we need people in every school that have a background like that and can empathize in a way that is that profound, right? Not just intellectually, but having lived some of those experiences.
Yeah. I remember, you know, just as an analogy, I once heard someone say that the instructions to assemble a piece of furniture should be written by someone who actually really struggled to put it together. Someone who really wanted that piece of furniture and worked really, really hard to assemble it, rather than the instructions, you know, just sort of being written by the designers or people who knew in advance, you know, how that piece of furniture was constructed. And yeah, I think that there's a sort of a useful analogy for what I've been talking about here, about how a lot of people who, you know, are involved in the education system, or people who write about social class, you know, a lot of them tend to already come from educated backgrounds, involved in higher education for a long time. Many of the sort of, you know, writers or journalists or academics who are interested in social class or write about it, maybe they, you know, they didn't come up in the same way that I did, or the way that some of these kids did.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Diana calling us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Diana.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, so I just wanted to just basically thank you for telling your story. I think growing up, being in, like migrating from Mexico, I had to learn how to be Mexican and American, and I also had to learn how to be American, and I had to basically do all these things with my parents who were, not that they weren't involved, but they were working all the time. So TV definitely influenced the things that I did and just understood pop culture and how to be friends with my friends. Just like the list of movies that my friends give me are all like 80s, like super classic American movies. And I'm like, I've never watched 16 Candles. I don't know what you're talking about. And then once I watch it, it makes me make sense of like what is going on around me. And I'm like, whoa, like how would that have changed my confidence or like given me if I had known that that's what people were watching? And I just, I wonder if you are interested in making any kind of shows or movies and like what that portrayal would look like for like people that are learning how to live through the TV or anything like that.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So right now I'm working on writing a memoir. I've recently signed with a publisher, and you know, as I'm going through and going through like chapter by chapter, you know, I think that like, yeah, this might make an interesting, you know, an interesting like sort of on-screen depiction of upward mobility. Other people have told me this too, like, you know, people that I knew at Yale, people here at Cambridge, you know, when I sort of, you know, delve into my personal background, you know, they said like, oh, this would be such an interesting miniseries. Now I have no sort of plans or anything as of now to do anything like that. But I will just continue to write about it, and to, you know, maybe if this book gains some interest, I think this could be sort of an interesting sort of story to tell in that way. I remember a few years ago there was that movie Boyhood, mm-hmm. In like 2013, 2014, and I thought it was like a decent movie, but you know, I wasn't that, you know, wowed by it. I think that there were sort of undercurrents and sort of complexities that they could have done a better job of exploring. So yeah, I think that there is a story, other stories to tell.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Did TV ever steer you wrong? Did you ever have assumptions based on the characters you watched that didn't really bear out when you were around people who were of a similar class background to the characters depicted on TV and in movies?
Yeah, I'm sure it did. I can't think of any example specifically, but just like generally, you know, of course, like, you know, shows like The OC or like, you know, some other like teen dramas, yeah, they would, I mean, of course, like they always had like the moral of the story is don't do this bad thing,
right.
But like, you know, of course, like a character would like just get really hammered and drive a car and get, you know, get into an accident or something like that. And, you know, I think like probably some of that rubbed off. Now, for me specifically, I didn't actually do this, but I distinctly remember classmates of mine, male classmates, who loved watching the MTV show Jackass.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, they always had that disclaimer at the front, you know, do not attempt these stunts or whatever. But like they would do it. They would do the exact same stupid things that they saw or whatever sort of, you know, poor imitation of it that they could. So yeah, I think, you know, of course for me, maybe I focus more on the positive lessons that I drew from TV, but, of course, like there are TV shows that I think influence people, maybe in not such a good direction.
I don't know how much time you have these days to watch TV, but I'm curious about your media diet.
Yeah. Right now I'm watching the HBO series Big Little Lies sort of intermittently when I have time. I don't have as much time for TV as I used to. But, you know, Big Little Lies, it's an HBO series. It's prestige TV. I find like more and more that's kind of the television that I'm consuming, maybe because I've sort of, you know, to some extent assimilated into this sort of educated class. You know, every once in a while I'll watch like a rerun or an older episode of Mad Men. Another show that I watched, probably like the last, like, you know, sort of show that I seriously binge watched before I started college was The Affair. the Showtime series, which I enjoyed quite a bit, actually, even though I didn't, this is a another show where I didn't like the characters that much, but I actually found the show to be really interesting. One reason why I liked that show, and I came to discover it through a New Yorker article by Emily Nussbaum. So she wrote something like, you know, the Showtime series, The Affair, the characters in that show are the kind of people who would watch that show, sort of affluent, well-to-do people. And when I read that, I thought like, okay, well, I definitely have to check this show out. That show, maybe in a similar way to The West Wing, the producers of the show almost took for granted that they didn't have to like explain these characters, or like they just assumed that the audience would come from the same world as the characters, and so they didn't need you know, something like an audience surrogate to help explain what it's like to be in this highly affluent world. Something like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, for example, Will Smith is a sort of surrogate for the audience. You know, he's from Philadelphia, and then he moves to this rich family with his aunt and uncle, and so we're sort of experiencing wealth through his eyes. And it's the same kind of thing with Mad Men, which I write about in that New York Times essay. So Don Draper is this rags to riches guy. You know, he grew up in like the Dust Bowl or something in the Great Depression. And he sort of like is, you know, has this sort of poor background. And so for him, living among, you know, these rich advertising executives in Manhattan, we're sort of experiencing that world through his eyes. But The Affair was just like, you know, these are, you know, rich people. They went to Williams College. I think I made that joke in that essay. You know, if a show uses Williams College, you know that it's geared for the elite, because you know, only the elite knows what Williams College is. I don't know what Williams College is. I mean, I do now, but I didn't, you know, 5 years ago. If that show had been aimed at the mainstream, those characters would have attended, you know, Princeton or Harvard or some like instantly recognizable college that, you know, every person would have heard of.
Really briefly, we just have a few seconds left. You note in the piece that you still wonder if TV taught you to get what you'd always wanted, or it taught you what you were supposed to want. Have you answered that question for yourself?
I haven't answered it. I'm not sure that I ever will. And I think, you know, since writing that piece and reflecting on it more, I think I'm okay with that. I'm comfortable with accepting that, you know, to some degree it was a sort of a window into another world, and maybe in other ways it was more of a mirror reflecting back at me what I wanted, and I can sit with the tension.
Rob Henderson is an Air Force veteran, a Yale graduate, and a PhD student at the University of Cambridge. His essay for the New York Times was titled "Everything I Know About Elite America I Learned from Fresh Prince and West Wing." Rob, thanks so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can find the Think podcast wherever you get podcasts, or catch up at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.